How we play and how we teach our children to play are tremendously important narratives in public life. Today's guest argues that toys are texts, and we should read them with the same analytical eye we bring to books, movies, songs, and other media. He's Jonathan Alexandrados, this week on Story in the Public Square. Hello and welcome to Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. I'm Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Salve Regina University, and this is my co-host, G. Wayne Miller from the Providence Journal. Stories are everywhere, in books, in movies, in photographs, and according to our guest, even in toys. Jonathan Alexandrados is a playwright and professor of English at Queensborough Community College in New York City. His edited collection of academic essays on the narrative in toys is titled Articulating the Action Figure, Essays on the Toys and Their Messages, and will be out in May of 2017 from McFarland. Jonathan, thank you for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
So let's unpack this a little bit. Toys and comics are texts.
Yeah.
Well, what does that mean?
It means that you can take a toy, starting with toys, you can take an action figure, a toy, and you can apply to it the same lenses that you do to traditional media, books, movies, songs, what have you. That means that I can take an action figure and look at it through the lens of Judith Butler, and from that lens get out of it something on gender theory. I can look at it through the writings of someone like Ta-Nehisi Coates and figure something out perhaps about race theory. I can apply those lenses and get something out of the toy that way. That tells me that these toys are readable, right? Mm. They're not just things that you sit alone in a room and play with or have your kids play with. They're things that you can actually read. So ideally, what I kind of would love to envision is just a college course where instead of buying books, you're buying action figures, you're buying toys, and you're sitting down and you're reading the backs of them in the context of, let's say, Simone de Beauvoir or Aristotle or someone like that. There's a lot there.
Is there a specific example of one that you can sort of walk us through?
Absolutely. It's a few years old now, but you remember the Incredible Hulk movie?
Sure.
The one with Edward Norton? So they put out a wave of action figures for that movie, and the first wave had four figures in it, three of which were the Hulk, different versions of the Hulk, and one of those was Abomination, the bad guy in the movie. And so the first thing you realize is, okay, all three are male, but you sort of get that because, you know, it's the Incredible Hulk and there is, you know, Betty Ross, but she never gets an action figure. So that's the first red flag that goes off. But then you take a look at the language that's being used on the cards of these action figures. Words like action, power, punch, you know, what do all these words suggest you? Well, they suggest the active male. Mm-hmm. First person to really talk about that was Aristotle. That's going back way, way, way back into the ancient Greeks. So you look at the language that Aristotle's using to describe masculinity, you're seeing it in the packaging for the Incredible Hulk action figures, and then you're going to read Simone de Beauvoir's The Second Sex, who says, look, eventually we're going to get to the point in our society where those Aristotelian words for masculinity are so hidden in our society that we won't even realize it. And the fact that we're on these packages that we don't talk about means that actually, to some degree, Simone de Beauvoir is proven right here. Like, this is the language. We don't quite recognize it. By studying it in this way, we sort of pull it out of the shadows, and it actually becomes something that we can discuss. And then we can move into Simone de Beauvoir's point of, you know, well, Aristotle also said that the feminine is passive. What do we think about that? Hopefully our 21st century answer is we hate that, and we want to fight against this idea of feminine passivity and talk then about, well, maybe there should be a Betty Ross action figure. Maybe there should be action figures of women that are not traditionally represented. Maybe we should change this.
So what you say is obviously true, and that would speak to adult collectors of toys and adult readers of comics. But toys and comics have a very unique role informing the opinions, the values, the philosophies of children. You know, the young brain is at a very, you know, impressionable age. It's learning to be the person. Talk about how what you were just saying here, the lessons from the texts from toys and comics, relate to what a child, almost from birth, really, because that's what you give a kid, along with the clothes, you give the kid the toys. How does that shape the future adult?
Absolutely. Well, you're through a toy. That is a lot, in a lot of cases, the first sort of strange body that a child is going to touch. I mean, it's a plastic body. And I think that means a lot. There's a kindergarten teacher, Vivian Gusson Paley, who did a lot of research on how toys impact child development. And in her book, The Boy Who Would Be a Helicopter, Paley writes about this boy who was given a helicopter toy, a toy helicopter. And every day in class, he just played with that helicopter off by himself in a corner. Every day she'd try to bring him out, you know, come play with the other kids, here are their toys, interact with them, create a story. No, I want to play with this helicopter. I want my own story. This is my helicopter. Ultimately, what she tried to do was use the other children's toys to prove that a helicopter was needed in all these other stories. And once this kid kind of saw that a helicopter could be useful in these other stories, he started to open up a little bit. Paley's conclusion from this is that what this child is doing is using a toy to gain empathy. And empathy then is the building block on which all other human communication is kind of based. And if you don't have that, you know, gosh, is that a sociopath at that point? Like, I think empathy is so important. And toys give us that ability because they help us to create stories. They act as avatars for ourselves in fantasy stories. And by doing that, you then learn to involve other people in those stories. And once you pull someone else into your story, there's the empathy. And that's what Paley's kind of getting at.
They also shape gender identity, you know, from a very early age. And I wanted to go back to the 60s and continuing through today. Both of these toys in comics and TV series, to one extent or another, are still with us, and that is the iconic G.I. Joe and the iconic Barbie.
Yeah.
And both of those toys, and we could have a whole program on this, have changed over the years. But in the early days, in terms of gender identity and where a male or a female belonged or should be in society, talk about how those toys shaped and reinforced those perceptions of oneself.
Totally. Well, Barbie, you know, started as certainly a girl's toy, and a toy created sort of in response to this idea that you know, girls had these paper dolls that they would play with, and those kind of embodied the typical role of the woman in the 1950s, the sort of the mom or the, you know, the sort of conservative woman. Barbie sort of comes out and gives girls a plastic version of those paper dolls that they can kind of dress up, and a lot of those roles kind of stayed, you know, pretty traditional, and Barbie kind of maintained that course, although lately Barbie has branched out into many, many different careers that have, you know, I think opened the door to new sort of gender identities and new roles for the girls playing with them. But in the early days, in the 60s, there certainly was not this array of careers for Barbie that there is now. Now there's even an array of body types. There was one body type, you know, for a very long time. And I can only imagine, and I literally mean that, I can only imagine being a girl who didn't fit that body type. If I didn't see myself represented in that figure, and I mean figure in both of its meanings, figure as in bodily figure and figure as in action figure, I would feel quite lost, I'd imagine. G.I. Joe, on the other hand, gave boys, and specifically marketed towards boys, a very active action figure. I mean, that's where we get the word action figure is from G.I. Joe. And if you look at the advertising for the first set of G.I. Joe figures, it's action marine, action, you know, diver, action, you know, all of these action. Much like the example with the Hulk figures, that language of the active male is there. And if you were a boy, you know, there's a heck of an example for you. Buff, masculine, you know, ready to go.
And famously white. right? So you know, both Barbie and G.I. Joe traditionally have been white characters.
Yeah.
How does that sort of factor into our discussion of toys as toys as text?
Well, I think it factors in, getting back to that word avatar. If you are a child of color and you're not seeing yourself reflected in the toys that you're playing with, how can you fully be expected to immerse in a fantasy the way a white child can? You don't see yourself represented. And then you basically get delivered a message that says, this fantasy play is off limits to you. And I think that's incredibly detrimental to a child's experience. I can say, you know, personally, obviously, I haven't had that experience, but growing up, I was incredibly overweight, and there were not overweight action figures. Mm-hmm. Like, action figures had a specific body type. So not being able to find a figure that looked like me physically told me that, hey, I'm wrong. Mm-hmm. Like, these figures, that's clearly the ideal. What I am is not the ideal, so I need to change myself. Now, when you're talking about something like weight, well, okay, there are ways about to go about doing that. But when you're talking about something like race or gender, not only is there no way to do that, but you shouldn't do that. Mm-hmm. Like, your whatever race you are is great. Whatever gender you are is great. Like, there's no reason to change that. So diversifying toys, I think, is absolutely necessary. I didn't mention race before, only because I can think of some early examples of African-American representation in Barbie and G.I. Joe, but they're very, very rare, very, very rare, and historically incredibly low-selling then, not so much now.
Well, there seems to be a sort of a broader shift that's taken place in the last 40 years in popular culture, right? So, yeah. You know, I think a lot of people have seen Rogue One,
yeah,
with a female heroine.
Yeah.
The whole Star Wars series, frankly, yeah, is full, yeah, of female heroes.
Yeah.
Is this just part of the feminist movement, you know, finding its expression in popular culture, and toys have been lagging in that respect?
Yeah, I think that toys do tend to lag a little bit behind where society is as kind of a movement. But I think there's incredible fan demand from both men and women and people who are non-binary to get female representation in toys. It is ridiculous. Like, if you were getting the first wave of Force Awakens Black Series action figures, so the 6-inch mm-hmm. toys, it was impossible to get a Rey action figure, right, at that time, right? Because they were short packed. They were making fewer of them than the male characters.
That's something that got a lot of news when
yeah,
because people thought that there was some sort of implicit bias in the manufacturing decisions.
Exactly. And what did they do? They took to Twitter. Hashtag where's Rey?
Yeah.
Hashtag where's Black Widow, which happened with the Black Widow figures,
right,
which were in the same boat. And I do believe that changed work. I think that they also could look at certain sales figures from other companies. They could say, look, you know, the IM Elemental action figures, which started off on Kickstarter as an independent third-party action figure, started selling amazingly well. And those are all action figures geared towards girls, female superheroes embodying virtues. You could look at DC Superhero Girls, Mattel's line. Those figures selling remarkably well. So hopefully, you know, if they have to think in numbers, then they can at least say, well, the numbers exist to say that fans want female representation in action figures. It's there. Everything supports it.
So we're going to pick this up in a second, but we need to do a station identification. This is Story in the Public Square, a joint initiative of the Pell Center at Southern Virginia University and the Providence Journal. I'm Jim Lutis, alongside my friend and co-host G. Wayne Miller. We're produced each week in the studios of Rhode Island PBS, and an audio version of the program is broadcast 4 times each weekend on Sirius XM Channel 124, the POTUS channel. Our guest is Jonathan Alexandrados, playwright and author who sees narrative in toys. I want to bring Wayne back into this conversation.
So we've just had a presidential election in which it could be reasonably argued that some of the old gender and racial stereotypes were brought back to the forefront or resurrected or reinforced. And I think that's a reasonable argument. And certainly with some candidates and in some campaigns, those are issues. Was there any reflection of that in toys and comics, and I'm thinking comics especially. We can get to that in a second because Marvel has brought out this wonderful Muslim character. But did you see any shift at all in comics or toys during the election?
Sure, absolutely. If you want to start with comics, there had been what I thought was a fantastic shift in comics leading up into the election. Examples of different types of women being represented as superheroes. If you look at the comic book Faith, put out by Valiant, that features a woman who is overweight as a superhero, and as the election was coming up, they had a Hillary Clinton tie-in into the comic book. Ooh. So I think that I look at that issue as an example of a comic book saying, we are taking feminist representation seriously, and we see it as tied to a particular candidate. Other examples of this, the Unbeatable Squirrel Girl, Miss Marvel, which is what you were alluding to, Moon Girl and Devil Dinosaur. In those three examples, you have a woman who, Squirrel Girl, atypical in terms of body type, if you look at the history of comics. Miss Marvel, Pakistani-American. Moon Girl, African-American. Incredible range of diversity there. Does that mean everything is fixed? Absolutely not. There's some other damning evidence on the other side to suggest that our gender biases are still alive and well. Young Justice, that TV show, was canceled. The Green Lantern animated series was canceled. And when Bruce Timm was asked, why were these things canceled? They were doing so well. He said, because people at DC said that girls were into them, and girls were the market, and girls don't buy stuff. So they canceled it because it's all about selling that merch.
Wow.
And
so that was regression, I guess, would be the word.
Exactly. But, I mean, in order to say regression, I mean, we also have to think about how far are we truly moving forward? What I see studying this stuff is that there's always just bubbling under the surface this sexism that's there. And I'm pointing out sexism specifically, but we could say misogyny, we could say racism, we could say, you know, you could pursue
all sorts of bad stuff.
Yes. Yeah.
And not always bubbling under the surface. I mean, I think it broke through the surface during the election.
Yes.
In some quarters, certainly.
Oh, for sure. Absolutely.
I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about Ms. Marvel, because
sure.
it's a fascinating character, and in particular, maybe you could tell sort of the audience a little bit about who she is, and what that narrative speaks to.
Absolutely. So just to preface this by saying, Miss Marvel, I've taught her first issue in my class at Queensborough Community College, where I teach remedial English, because I have a student body that's incredibly diverse and they've never seen anyone like her. So her real name is Kamala Khan, and Kamala Khan is a Pakistani-American girl who lives in Jersey City, New Jersey. And basically, one day she wakes up to discover that she is now the inheritor of these superpowers. And her first issue is basically the question of, how do I reconcile this new role with my Muslim identity? Mm-hmm. How do those things go together? And I've never seen that discussed in a comic book before. So when I read that for the first time, I was like, oh my gosh, this is mind-blowing. And when I gave it to the students, plenty of whom are young Muslim girls, they're just blown away by it too. They've never seen anything like it.
Well, and the comic books have a long history of grappling with sort of broader societal issues. Mm-hmm. And I think of just what the Captain America series did in the aftermath of 9/11, and in the context of the American debate, the American public political debate over whether or not we should be torturing.
Yeah.
And in that universe, they actually had a civil war.
Yeah.
Trying to resolve this issue about what is too far and what won't we do in the name of security.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that just shows you that comic books and toys are tools. And it's our job as a society to use them to address the issues that are around us. I think we can make the choice to say, oh, this is a junk medium, which is the term I get I hear that term a lot, the term junk medium. That gets thrown around so much. Oh, it's for kids. Why on earth would you want to talk about this? We could say that, But then you're negating all of that work that you're talking about, I'm talking about. Or we could say that these are tools, and we can use them to represent, we can use them to explain, we can use them to teach, and that's what I want to do.
And, you know, of course, it isn't just for kids. If you look at any of the Comic Cons, and I know you're involved very deeply in one of them, Denver,
yep.
These things sell out months and years in advance. They're, you know, attended by many adults, mostly adults,
yeah.
Some parents with their kids. And
yeah.
So culturally, it isn't just for kids or here in the background. It's very much on the forefront. And Marvel, of course, is a giant corporation and has made all kinds of money, not just in comics, but in adaptations to the screen.
Oh, for sure. And as of, I think, a year or two ago, the Washington Post reported that that the bulk of gamers were women. Mm-hmm. You know, this is a culture that I think women, minorities, especially if you look at the new Black Panther comics written by Ta-Nehisi Coates, I mean, people who did not have access to this are now taking it for themselves, and they should, because it's been closed to them for too long. And I absolutely think it's a beautiful thing to see this just open up and open up and open up.
How did you start this journey? How did you wind up sort of a scholar of toys? Because it sounds, frankly, like nice work if you can get it.
Yeah,
it sounds like a dream job, actually. Do you have any openings?
Yes. It doesn't pay anything. It started because I was early on in my writing career as a playwright, and I was writing a lot of stuff that had nothing to do with me. And I was cranking this material out. I went to grad school, and my teacher, the playwright Tina Howe at the time, asked me a very simple question, which was just, what are you interested in? And I said, well, you know, I'm a geek. Like, I like toys, and I like action figures, and I like comics. And she's just reading this play of mine. It's like, well, there's none of that in here. Why is that? And I'm like, well, there's none of it in there, because I thought I had to be miserable when I'm writing this stuff. And she's like, no, this should be something joyful to you. It should be something that's interesting to you.
Suffering artist.
Yeah.
Toiling for your craft.
Yeah, exactly. Like, doing the research late at night on, you know, Mozambique or something. Like, I'm a god, you know. Let me just write about what's around me. So I looked around my life, you know, for all these years, these action figures have been in my life. And why don't I say something about that, you know? So creatively, as a playwright, I started to tell those stories. And then as I started to do that, I started to think about academic writing. And I started to think about, well, what would happen if I took that philosophy and applied it to academic writing? What would happen then? And then it was like, oh, well, then it would have to be action figures. And there's so much cool stuff in action figures. What would happen if I took this literary theory, applied it to action figures, and then voila, you get these essays out of it.
So I want to go back even further in your background.
Yeah, great.
You were kind enough, many of our guests bring us books or some kinds of tokens, and you were kind enough to bring us this action figure.
Yes.
And I'm going to hand it to you, and I'd like you to tell our audience, our radio and TV audience,
sure,
what it is, why it's important, and why you brought it here.
Okay, absolutely. So it was a Sunday afternoon in, let's call it 1992, something like that. KB Toys, Westtown Mall, Knoxville, Tennessee. KB Toys no longer with us. My dad and I went in. And for whatever reason, I remember it being a cold afternoon. I don't think it matters. Let me pick out one item. And I went right to this guy. He was packaged up at the time as a Crimson Guard Immortal action figure from G.I. Joe, A Real American Hero. And I had no idea who this character was. Something just drew me to him, perhaps the red outfit. Probably the red outfit. I kind of liked it. And my dad said, okay, you can get that one, paid for it. I took it home, and all of a sudden, this character became everything. This character became the savior of the world. This character became the biggest supervillain in the world. This character became the waiter. This character became the, you know, whatever. And what I realized is that this was me. This was me doing all of the adventures that I wanted to have. And it was all because my dad took me to KB Toys in Westtown Mall on this, let's call it a Sunday, and let's call it 1992. that day. And so it became a very, very special item for me to have, and it had a lot of power, and I believe it still has that power.
Well, so in some respects, it's a totem, it's an avatar.
Yeah.
So today, 2017,
yeah.
We have video games and other technology, augmented reality, virtual reality, online worlds where you can create your own avatar, your right. own character. How is that changing play? And are the issues sort of the baggage that we had with a manufacturer decided that they were going to make that mold?
Yeah.
And now we have the ability to create our own characters and our own personas
yeah.
in the form of our own avis. Is that?
Sure. I think it's changing play in a fascinating way. If you think of it, though, manufacturers, toy manufacturers, have always been investigating ways to tie themselves closer to the most recent technology. If you remember Captain Power in the 1980s, you used to have to buy the VHS tape with that. And nowadays, if you think of something like Lego Dimensions is basically our modern Captain Power, because Lego Dimensions is where you buy a little Lego set, you build the little set that it comes with, but the thought is that you plug that into your video game, and then that becomes who you play. Mm-hmm. So if I buy a Lord of the Rings one, I'm Gimli. And so they're always going hand in hand like that. The one just very, very basic shift that it's making is it's actually killing the back of the box art and things on action figure cards. If you buy the Rogue One figures,
yeah.
If you look at the back, it's all about how you can download their app now and factor all this into the app. It's no longer the 62 other figures you can buy, or the backstory, right? Which I kind of miss.
We're out of time, but I wanted to give Wayne a chance for a 30-second question.
Great.
And that would be, it was just announced that Barnum & Bailey Circus, after almost 150 years, is going out of business this year. And actually, the second to last show is going to be here in Rhode Island.
Wow.
Childhood and play has changed, and you were talking about that. Do you see action figures ever going away? Do you see comics ever going away? Quick answer, because we are almost out of time.
Absolutely not. I think that thanks to the internet and the onset of 3D printing, we're just getting started.
We're going to have to leave it there because that is all the time we have this week. If you enjoyed the show, please be sure to check us out on Facebook and Twitter or visit us at pellcenter.org. Jonathan Alexandrados, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
For Wayne Miller, I'm Jim Lutis. Thank you for joining us.